It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Biden administration imposes a 20-year mining moratorium earlier this year, protecting hundreds of thousands of acres in the Superior National Forest. We examine the complexities of mining prosperity in the upper Midwest and the interplay of political, economic, and cultural forces as environmentalism and a powerful industry collide. Call in about mining. The number to join in with a question or comment is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Eric Cajola is a senior climate research specialist at Greenpeace USA. His book is called Mining the Heartland, Nature, Place, and Populism on the Iron Range. Eric, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So your book talks about these smokestack nostalgia, this concept of smokestack nostalgia and the romanticizing of mining's heyday in northern Minnesota. What do some people, you know, think about mining or idealize about mining? Can you take us there?
Yeah, sure. So on the Iron Range, which with folks don't know, is in the northeastern part of Minnesota, and it's a history that has a place that has a long history of mining. And so a lot of people remember that as kind of bringing the good life, right? And so, you know, as I spend time talking to people in the Iron Range, spending time up there, looking at museums, reading newspapers, I really found that there's this collective memory that mining was what made the place, what brought about the good life. And people remember, you know, the days when mostly men, you know, went into the mine for their shift and came back home and could support their families. They could also have time to go hunting and fishing, and that their downtowns were vibrant and busy, right? There were many, many bars to choose from to go have a drink after work. There were grocery stores, there were local bakeries. And so that memory, those emotional memories, right, those continue to shape how people think about their current situation, and it also shapes how they imagine the future and the hopes that they have for the future.
You also set up a different camp of people, if you will, people who have paddled the boundary waters in northern Minnesota, who have a different type of nostalgia. How do these environmentalists, as we would commonly label them, view the up north part of Minnesota?
Yeah, so for other folks, both in Minnesota and without, outside of Minnesota, they remember this place through maybe that childhood camping trip that they took into the boundary waters, or the time they went paddling with their summer camp into the BWCA. And those carry a lot of emotion. So I think why these memories are also so important and so powerful politically and socially is they resonate with people. They resonate emotionally. They connect to people's identities, you know, whether that's someone's identity as being a canoer, an outdoors person, someone who cares about nature, or someone's identity of, you know, living in a mining region, being from the range, as they call it. And so we see that there's different memories of the same place, and they all carry a lot of emotion and a lot of power, but they're also in conflict. And so a lot of groups who are concerned and maybe opposing some of the expansion of mining really draw on those memories of time spent in the boundary waters and outdoors to mobilize their supporters. And it's an effective way to mobilize people, as I found.
And one of the people you talk with to, you know, look at these tensions is Brandon, who has generations of family members working in the mines. It's been, you know, a way of life. And Brandon may not see eye to eye with those older generations of family members.
Yeah, so you definitely see some kind of generational differences, tensions. And that's both within, you know, people from the community. So I definitely talked to some, you know, folks who were in their 20s, maybe 30s, who were from northern Minnesota and the Iron Range, who were a little bit more ambivalent about mining. You know, they hadn't lived through, you know, the 50s and 60s boom in mining. To them, it maybe could create some jobs, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a miracle fix. It wasn't a panacea. And so there was some difference, I think, within those generations. Although even within, there's a lot of variation. So there are still younger people who work in some of the existing iron mines and work in some other industries who are supportive. But I did find that there is becoming a bit of a shift, and that people in the range may no longer see mining as the only thing, because they've realized they've lived through kind of tougher economic times, and they don't maybe trust that one industry is going to be the fix.
We're talking with Eric Cajola, author of the new book, Mining the Heartland. You can join in at any point about mining. The number to call in is 800-642-1234. Eric, in these 100 and more interviews you do, you say you intentionally left out Indigenous voices out of the ethnographic research. Why was that?
Yeah, this is a complex and complicated question that I've struggled with, that research historically has struggled with. There's a long history of research being extractive and being taking from Indigenous communities. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done to repair ties between academia, between researchers and Indigenous communities. And I felt that I wasn't able to do the proper relationship building to do that in an ethical and an accountable way, and a way that would be beneficial for Indigenous communities. Because the work that it took to build connections and rapport with both environmental groups, state experts and scientists, and then people on the Iron Range and union and industry leaders, that alone took a lot of work. And I felt like I couldn't kind of ethically a kind of balance being in relationship with all those groups. But I think what that means is that it continues to leave out some silences. But I think there's a lot of excellent Indigenous scholars and scholars who are working in kind of deep partnership with Indigenous communities that are doing really good work and research that can elucidate some more of those perspectives. But what I try to do throughout the book is also expose some of the silences and some of the things that maybe get left out or not talked about from the largely white respondents that I was talking to and engaging with. And to maybe expose, some of the histories of colonialism as well as the ongoing presence and use of Indigenous peoples on the land that get left out by other sides in these mining and land use conflicts.
And we're gonna dig into that in just a bit, but I want to ask you just to step back for a moment, and this new era of mining with copper nickel projects and the intent of trying to extract copper nickel, what are companies trying to do here with these mines and get out of them?
Yeah, so the Iron Range is named the Iron Range because there's been a lot of iron mining. And so what's being proposed now is a new type of mining. And this is largely to get out copper and nickel, although there's other metals in those deposits as well, but copper and nickel are the biggest. So for about 20 or 30 years, there's been a resurgence in interest from usually international mining companies to extract these metals from the Iron Range. And some of that is driven by the global prices for these commodities. When PolyMet, one of the companies, started exploring their project in Minnesota, it was at a time when the price of copper was really high, and so it was going to be more profitable potentially to operate this mine. But this comes in the context where we have depleted a lot of the really high-grade resources, some of the easier places to mine. This is both for metals. We also see this in oil and gas. And increasingly, we see industries turning to maybe riskier locations, harder to reach places, and lower grade ore, basically deposits that have less of the ore in it, and new places. And we're starting to see, whether it's, fracking in Texas or offshore drilling, more conflicts over sometimes these riskier forms of extraction.
We have sociologist Eric Cajola, climate and environmental justice researcher. New book is Mining the Heartland, puts a sharper focus on the complex struggles of mining and the competing political interests. And that's what we'll look at next. Call in with a question. You can share your comments along the way about mining. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Minnesota is the top iron-producing state in the country, according to its State Natural Resources Department. And a new book unpacks the cultural complexities of the rich history of mining in the upper Midwest, these deep underground mines pitting environmentalism against economic stability and historical jobs. You can share your thoughts at any point. Call in with a question about mining resources in Midwest communities at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have climate science researcher and sociologist Eric Cajola, author of Mining the Heartland. Eric, as you said, you toured a museum at the old Pioneer Mine in Ely, which closed in 1967, and you talked with people who had worked at the mine. What were these jobs like?
Yeah, so also if anyone's been to Ely, you can see the Pioneer Mine basically from downtown. So it's kind of an important visual cue in town. But yeah, talking to some of the guides and volunteers at the Pioneer Mine and other mines, mining museums on the range, a lot of them were retired former miners. And, you know, they talked about both how hard the work was, right? It was physically hard. It was challenging for the older mines like in Ely that were underground. There's a lot of risk. It's scary to be, you know, down a shaft down under the ground. But also that these jobs, through the struggles of workers to unionize, became good jobs, right? Someone growing up in the Iron Range could graduate high school and get a job in the mines and make a decent living. And that could support families, that could support communities. So there was both talk of this being hard, dangerous, dirty work, but also good work. And I think that meant it carried a sense of purpose, a sense of kind of moral meaning, and also a sense that, you know, their work was contributing to the world, to the nation, to the state. You hear a lot, you know, Minnesota's mines helped, you know, build the U.S. It helped the U.S. win World War II because of all that iron that was used in the steel. So you could really hear, talking to people, the resonance of these jobs and those fond memories, but also the struggles.
You know, you talk about going down a mine shaft and how scary and potentially really dangerous this work is. Also dangers to the miners' health. What did you find out about cancers or chemicals and public health hazards?
Yeah, so, you know, many others have done lots of research on the occupational health and safety risks of mining. There's been research documenting the effects of asbestos-like fibers on miners in Minnesota that has, you know, long-term impacts. And then there's, you know, other, you know, injuries that come in operating heavy machinery and things. So, you know, that was not something I was specifically researching, but I think is always important to remember that, you know, these mines carry environmental risks, but workers are on the front line of that, right? If there's toxic chemicals and other things, workers are often going to be the first ones exposed. But also, you know, workers are often the ones living near near those mines too, especially in mining communities. The workers are often, are sometimes, you know, the fence line communities as well. So it also points to some of the complexities around, you know, environment versus jobs, this narrative we often hear. But, you know, workers have a real concern and issues around these workplace and environmental safety issues.
So when mines close in northern Minnesota, as you traced where these miners go, what other job options were available to the workers?
Yeah, I think This is one of the challenges facing the Iron Range or other, mining and extractive regions. When a mine closes, there aren't a lot of other options. These are often kind of more rural and isolated places. And the way, extractive economies work, there usually isn't a very diversified economy. So, a lot of researchers have looked at how mining creates kind of boom and bust cycles. And can create kind of unstable economies. But on the range, you see a mix of things, right? So the healthcare industry is a kind of growing sector of employment, jobs and education, some of the basic things that you need for community, right? So the schools, the hospitals, public government jobs. But also then when you get closer to the boundary waters, so up near Ely, there are jobs in the tourism industry. And so you'll particularly hear from some environmental groups and conservation groups that tourism is an important and growing part of the economy, which is quite true. And they're concerned about some of the risks that mining could pose to that industry.
We're talking.
But I think, oh, go
I
ahead.
was just going to reintroduce you here for a moment. Eric Cajola, sociologist, author of Mining the Heartland, and you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Eric, Kathy and Rhinelander called in to say they worked in geology and on the Crandon Project in northeast Wisconsin. And Kathy says that they're not anti-mining, but they say that groundwater is much more of a valuable resource and that we need to protect our groundwater. Is that some sentiment echoing what you heard through your interviews from people who are very concerned about the environment?
One of the main themes that you hear about groups and others that are concerned about mining is the impacts to water, right? It can be groundwater, it can be surface water, but one of the main ways that these mines can pollute is water. And especially groups that were concerned about the Polymet mine, they talked about the need for clean water and that this mine could potentially affect waters where wild rice grows. It could affect Lake Superior. And then for groups who are really concerned about the mines near the boundary waters, right? A lot of what they talked about and were concerned about was losing the ability to have clean water in the boundary waters, right? They would tell stories about, you can go paddling in the boundary waters and dip your cup in the water and drink it right away. And they were concerned that that wouldn't happen again. And I'll also say that that is an important and powerful message, right? So groups really use that as a powerful public messaging because that resonated with a lot of people's experiences and desires for clean water.
Let's bring in Tom in Mineral Point. Tom, what would you like to bring up?
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I haven't read the book. Listening to the conversation, there's, the big movement toward electric cars, which I'm not against, but as you know, electric cars require a lot of metals that have to be mined. As you also know, they're run off of fossil fuels. Depending on where you are in Ohio or West Virginia, electric cars are powered by coal. So, having that we know those facts, how does the environmental movement square the circle that they demand electric cars? They go to the progressive governments demanding mandates to enforce electric cars, and at the same time, the same group of people generally are against any sort of exploratory mining. Can you square that circle for me? Again, I haven't read the book. Maybe you do it there.
Tom, thank you so much. Appreciate that. Eric, go ahead.
This is one of the points and issues you hear raised often. And I think there's a couple of things. I think it does point to this real tension, right? And also the issue that, right, our economy relies on material goods, right? Whether it's electric vehicles, but even, our cloud computing relies on facilities to run that, which requires energy, which also requires metals and minerals. And so there is a real, question that we need to grapple with as an economy and as a society is where do we get those metals, minerals, and things that we need to make things? And how do we do that in a just way? So, right, I think an important consideration is how do we make sure that the energy transition, electrification, whether it's cars or homes or whatever, doesn't mean that the burdens get pushed onto communities living near mining sites, which are often working class, in many places are indigenous, is often also in parts of the global south. But at the same time, I do want to present some caution, because often this is something that industry will argue and say, hey, we need to mine here because we need this for green energy. And at times, I think that can run into a bit of a rhetoric that overlooks that, we still have decisions about where these mines should happen, right? And it's complicated.
And I want to just pause there with sociologist Eric Cajola's book is Mining the Heartland. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the cultural and political forces over time in iron ore mining deposits around Lake Superior. Sociologist Eric Cajola conducted over 100 ethnographic interviews with people connected to northern Minnesota's Iron Range. And there's space to talk about mining and the impact, the way of life, the environmental aspect of it. Join in by calling with a question, a comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Eric Cajola is a climate researcher at Greenpeace USA, and the book is called Mining the Heartland. Eric, turning to Wisconsin here, a Canadian company received a permit to do exploratory drilling for copper and gold in May in the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest in northern Wisconsin. That's roughly a 3.5-hour drive, if you will, from Minnesota's Iron Range. Can you explain what is involved in getting permits to drill or mine on federal land?
Yeah, so the process can be quite long. So, what's going on in Wisconsin now is the really early stages. It's kind of the exploratory stages. You know, I don't know the details of the project, but, companies start out by doing some drilling, which they need to get some permits for, because just drilling alone can have some impacts, right? Just getting in the vehicles and things to make those pads where you do the drilling. But then from there, right, the companies, I'm assuming, are going to assess, the quality of the ore, where they want to drill. But then from there, they have to put together a full proposal to mine. And so, for example, PolyMet has been exploring a project in Minnesota, and that's been over 2 decades now. So in Wisconsin, you're still pretty far from there being an active mine, because there would need to be an environmental review process. And then after an environmental impact statement is created, the company would need to apply for a whole set of state and federal permits. And exactly what permits depends on who owns the land. So in this case, it sounds like it would be federal land. So there's federal agencies that will be involved. And it also depends on the mineral leases. So for example, in Minnesota, Twin Metals, the company that wants to mine closer to the Boundary Waters, those are federal mineral leases. And so the federal government has more say and power over granting those permits. But the PolyMet mine, the other one I've been looking at in Minnesota, those are private and some state. And so there's a lot of different jurisdictions that can get involved, and it really matters, who owns the lands, who owns the resources, what different types of bodies of water and things are going to be impacted by the potential project.
So many variables there. How has regulation of mining changed from the Trump administration to the Biden administration?
Yeah, so there haven't been kind of large full-scale changes in regulations, but there's been decisions on particular projects. And so you've seen, you know, whether it's the Bears Ears Monument in Utah or some drilling for oil and gas in Alaska, or the Twin Metals Mine have kind of been a back and forth with different federal administrations. So for the Twin Metals project, for example, the Trump administration reinstated some permits, leases to the company to mine, and kind of gave the project the green light. But then when the Biden administration came into power, they reversed a lot of those decisions. So we see kind of the back and forth on some of these projects and some of the different priorities of administrations.
Let's take another call. John is joining us in Duluth, Minnesota. John, hi.
Hello. Three things. One, the Iron Range area in Minnesota has the second largest copper reserve in the world and the third largest nickel reserve in the world outside of South Africa. I've talked to the people who are knowledgeable geologists about that. And two, the iron mining jobs on northeastern Minnesota has gone from roughly 25,000 jobs in the mid-1960s to about 6,000 jobs now. So the area needs a lot of decent-paying jobs. Thank you for letting me have my say. Have a good day.
Have a good day, John, and thank you for that. Certainly perspective there from someone who lives close to this area and has seen the decline of jobs in mining, Eric.
Yeah, you know, this speaks to real concern of the Iron Range, of other rural communities, other communities near mining, but also, you know, industrial areas that have seen deindustrialization. And I think it's the challenge that needs to be addressed. And I think there is a need for also other groups and government, environmental groups to put forth what a just transition for the Iron Range looks like. If more extractive industries aren't the solution, then how can we create a resilient economy that creates good jobs, but also creates jobs that give people meaning and purpose? And it's a challenge, but it's also something I think that can be done and ultimately will need to be done. This is also why you see some support. But I would also add that, you know, in my research, I find that the support for mining isn't just about the jobs, and that it's also about the cultural and the social meanings of mining and place and people's collective memories and identities. And it's also something that gets used by industry and politicians and some identities and divisions that get mobilized for political purposes.
I think that leads into this question of you talking with a retired miner named Tom in Ely, longtime union member, Democratic voter. What was Tom's opinion of mining?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of folks I talked to, you know, saw mining as kind of being part of their way of life, or part of what built the place. And so they see mining as being key to the future of the place as well. And that bringing back some new mining could be a way to kind of reinvigorate the place, but also give them a sense of moral purpose, give them a sense of their community kind of mattering, right? So I think this is also some of the bigger kind of divisions and political rhetoric that you see, right? So whether it's urban versus rural tensions, or the sense that, you know, rural and Midwest too, maybe more broadly, this idea that it's not being listened to. So I think that's also why there's political power in saying, hey, politicians saying, we're going to bring back mining as a way to kind of bring back that sense of identity and sense of purpose. But also some people had some skepticism, you know, it's not like there's wholesale belief in these projects. And I think especially from folks who come from the labor movement and who are still affiliated with the Democratic Party, there was also some healthy skepticism of the mining companies and their claims, although they maybe were generally still supportive of mining development.
Talking with Eric Cajola, author of the new book, Mining the Heartland. Let's bring in Matt now in Madison. Matt, hi, what is your question?
Hi, I just wanted to make more of a statement. I did some research on the long-term effects on the small towns in the Iron Range after the mines left. And what I did was compare income for people in those communities to the income of communities in northern Wisconsin that didn't have mining. And what I found was the long-term benefit of mining is non-existent. There similar communities in northern Wisconsin that didn't mine and communities in northern Minnesota that did are almost identical in financial makeup. The only difference being that one of their communities has their environment extremely degraded. That's the only difference I can see.
What about the diversity of industries, the diversity of the economy? Did you look into that, Matt?
Well, I understand that we need nickel and we need copper. I'm not ignorant of that. But I do believe that there's other, you know, destroying the last of our pristine areas shouldn't be a viable option to me.
Matt, thank you so much. Eric, what do you see there in Matt's analysis, you know, comparing a rural community that doesn't have mining versus one that does and how those economies contrast?
Yeah, this isn't something that I specifically study, but there is other research that has looked at how extractive economies, you know, mining-based economies, you know, lack some stability, become boom and bust. And so, you know, I don't know the specifics, but there is some general kind of concern about the stability of mining economies. But I think this also, Matt's point gets at another important issue is that for some folks, right, the short-term gains of some mining don't outweigh the potentially long-lasting or irreversible impacts to land and water, right, and that they're you can't really go back from polluting the waters of the boundary waters or, you know, once you turn a piece of land into an open pit mine, you know, there is really no reclamation of that. So I think you also see in some of these debates, you know, different perceptions of risk and different priorities. So people look at the same project and come away with different assessments of what the risks are. And whether or not costs and benefits outweigh each other.
Eric Cajola explaining how environmental, cultural, and class politics collide in the mining industry. The book is Mining the Heartland. And you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question, thoughts on this issue, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have sociologist Eric Cajola, who immersed himself in the cultural struggles and the political conflicts of the mining industry. Book is called Mining the Heartland. Join in about natural resource-dependent communities. What struggles surface for you? The number to call in with a question or a comment, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Miriam now in Juneau. Miriam, hi.
Hello. Good morning to you all. Hope you're doing well. And I have an idea, a dream that I have no idea how it'd be enforceable. And that is when you have open pit mines or maybe other types of mines, is to require that those who are doing the mining to replace and take, you know, keep the topsoil and reforest it afterwards. Okay, you're finished. Now take what you took away and do your best to replenish it and make it beautiful once again, the best they can. I have no idea how they could be enforced because it would obviously be different than it was before, but that's my dream to require that. So if you've got an idea how to enforce something like that, maybe you share my dream. That's all I have to say about that.
Miriam, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that sentiment. You know, how could mines mitigate the environmental damage and clean up what a mine has caused?
Yeah, so thanks for that comment. In Minnesota, there are laws that are and requirements that are part of what's called the permit to mine, about companies also putting up, basically showing that they have the resources and the money to help with what's called remediation, basically clean up afterwards. But that's also been one of the issues that's been contested, and there's some ongoing litigation about whether or not PolyMet, in this example, has put up enough resources to adequately fund cleanup, because this is a notorious problem right across the U.S. and the world, where these companies come in, and whatever extractive industry it might be, they leave behind a mess, and then they leave and they don't clean up. And so, yeah, there are efforts to create legal mechanisms for that accountability, ensuring that can happen. I think on the Iron Range, you're seeing an interesting example where some of the iron mines have been remediated. You know, so now there's like in Ely, there's a lake that you can go swimming and paddling in that was an old pit that's filled in, or there's some mounds that now are parts of parks and things like that. And so I think people look at that and say, hey, I live next to mining, old mining, and it's kind of okay. But the problem is that now the new copper nickel mining that's being proposed is potentially more risky and more polluting. And, you know, you're probably not going to want to go swimming or fishing out of a copper nickel mine that's filled in with water, because that water could potentially be acidic and have heavy metals and things in it. So, again, it's where this kind of memory maybe collides with the new industries being proposed.
When you did these interviews with your sources and these people who were near remediation type sites, did they feel positive about what the mining company had done after the mine was closed?
Yeah, this was interesting. I definitely saw that there was some difference here. So I talked to some folks who were involved with environmental conservation groups. And they saw some of this remediation as really kind of a scar on the earth and inadequate, and as almost a kind of visual reminder of what mining would bring. But on the other hand, some folks who maybe had connections to the mining industry in the past, or maybe from multi-generations on the Iron Range, actually saw these as fruitful and part of their everyday life. Maybe it was a mine pit where they could go fishing, and thought that the companies had done a decent job. But also, I think it's important to remember that some of those companies that did the iron mining are not the same as some of the global multinationals that are looking to do the current copper nickel mining. And there may be more risks associated with the new mining, and that, you know, there's concern from some that the mining companies might not stay around to do that cleanup.
I wonder about you in doing the ethnographic research on this and communicating with all these different perspectives. How did you gain the trust? How did you allow, you know, were people willing to allow you in to show their true feelings about mining, which had, you know, has such a historic tradition in that area?
Yeah, and it was a challenge and a process and something I was kind of constantly navigating. And so with environmental groups, you know, at the time of doing a lot of the research, I was a graduate student at the University of Minnesota. You know, I lived in the Minneapolis. They kind of understood where I was coming from.
You right? were from the city.
I was in the city, right?
Or the cities, plural.
Yeah. Right. And so, but then up north, right, that could be a challenge, right? And so there was some hesitancy about you know, those same things about me, right, were a point of concern. But I found people also warmed up a little bit once I talked to them more and expressed a desire to understand different sides. Also, when people heard my last name, so I say Kajola, which is a mispronounced version of the Finnish name, which I think is more like Koyala. And so, you know, folks on the Iron Range, there's a lot of Finns, they would know that my name was Finnish. They would open up saying, yeah, you know, like my great grandparents lived in Hibbing. And, you know, not that I'm from the Iron Range by any means, but I think that little bit of connection opened up some doors and people on the Iron Range and from unions and things relaxed a little bit. But certainly, like, I showed up at someone's house driving my Prius, and that was definitely the brunt of some jokes. But, you know, I think being open and honest, people want to tell their stories and do want to talk.
You mentioned a Prius, and most of us use products that minds produce, whether it's in the cars or the computers, our devices, solar panels. I mean, the list is just endless. How can we approach this? How can we mitigate the environmental damage and keep the Iron Range and other rural communities here in Wisconsin in our thoughts and figure out a path forward as we look at the effects of mining?
Yeah, I think this is where questions of justice and democracy come into play, right? Do we have decision-making processes that are just democratic and collaborative, in which we can make decisions about where do we maybe extract some of the resources that we need? And then also to make sure there's accountability for that to be done in the safest ways possible. Because very often, right, these companies try and skirt around the rules and do the least. But also, I think we need to look at other things, like how do we recycle? How do we design products in ways that they require less materials, or design materials that are less polluting or less intensive? So I think we need to think as an economy and as a society holistically around how do we change the material requirements of our economy? But that's it's not simple, and it's a big task. And that's the challenge when you're also in a small town that's making a decision about a particular mine.
Did this book project change you in any way? Even though you're not from the Iron Range, did you feel changed?
Yeah, it was a really amazing opportunity to get to spend some more time up there and to dive deeper into a place that, you know, I'd heard about from like family stories and going up on occasion, but to spend a little bit more time up there and to understand more of the tensions and conflicts around, you know, what we often see as environment versus jobs, but seeing that those divisions were really a lot messier and that, you know, people on both sides care about jobs and care about the environment. But it's often, I think, some of the powerful actors that are mobilizing those divisions and tensions.
Eric, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Kate. I really appreciated the conversation.
Eric Kajola, author of Mining the Heartland, Nature, Place, and Populism on the Iron Range. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.